The show started here.
Well, that was the foxhole one.
That was the foxhole one.
Okay, welcome to everyone out there. This is Amateur Radio Roundtable. I'm Tom Edlin, W5KUB, and this is November the 24th. We're getting really close to Thanksgiving, my favorite holiday of the year ever since I was a kid. I remember Thanksgiving. Anyway, hey, if you're watching, you probably realize the chat is not working at W5KUB.com. And I don't know why. You know, it seemed like all these little software things, you know, it looks like all these developers could fix stuff. But, you know, we're running a WordPress website. And if I make one little change on that page, even if it's not in relation to ship to the chat room, but if I make one little change on that page, when it loads the new page up, it deletes some chat room code on purpose, and I have to go in there manually and fix it. So that's what I'll do tonight after the show, and we'll fix that. So sorry for you guys, not in a chat room tonight. A lot of us use IRC clients, programs that you can load, and they're really much better than that little web client there. So things like MIRC and HexChat. I personally am using HexChat tonight. So you might look into that, and you can just put our, you can put Freenode in there and the pound W5KUB, and you'll have a great client there for the chat room. And it does a lot of things for you. Let's see, if you're listening out there on WBCQ, let me make a couple announcements here. We have moved on WBCQ to Thursdays. So we're on BCQ, the WBCQ on 7490 on Thursdays from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Eastern time. And we hope that you enjoy the program. It's a ham radio program. And if you are listening out there, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email to Tom at W5KUB.com. Tom at W5KUB.com. Send us an email. Let us know where you are and how you're hearing the show tonight. And would love to hear from you. So let's jump right into the show tonight. We've got several things to talk about tonight. And let's just jump right over. It looks like Katie is up first there. Hey, Katie, how you doing?
Hello, Tom. Hi, everybody out there. Nice to be back this week and looking forward to a small Thanksgiving this year, which is actually not that different than any other year. And been just doing a few projects around here, and I know that we got a nice email from a new listener, so I just wanted to give a shout out to Chris, Whiskey 4 November Radio Golf. Thank you so much for your nice comments about the show, and glad you're joining us. And I have the feeling you'll be able to learn a lot from all of the experts that are on the show, of which I do not include myself as one, but but glad to have you join us, and thank you so much for sending in the nice email to Tom. And looking forward to this coming December. I mean, there's a lot of things coming up with the holidays, and always fun when there's little ones in your life to do some planning. And we celebrated my mom's birthday yesterday, WI7MOM, surprised her with a family Zoom type of gathering. So got to see a bunch of my family on the East Coast, which was really nice. So, you know, and okay. I just wanted to greet everybody to stay safe and healthy. And, you know, if you can't do things the way you used to, just come up with a new way of doing it.
Hey, I thought your mom lived next door to you.
She does, but the rest of the family's back east.
So okay.
My siblings were on, her sister, a niece, the cousins all popped in to say hello. So it was a lot of fun.
Okay. Well, I didn't understand the Zoom part when she was next door. I thought, man, you're really taking this to, extremes there. Okay. Well, very good there. And hey, thanks for mentioning the person that sent us that email. I don't have it in front of me, but that was one of our podcast listeners. He downloads it and listens to our show all during the day during work. So I'm sure he doesn't get a lot of work done, but I don't know. Maybe he does. I don't know. All right. Well, let's jump around the room here. How about Alan? What are you doing tonight, Alan?
Hey, good evening, and glad to be in here. And happy birthday to your mom there, Katie. So we've done a number of those family Zoom things when we first started locking down here in New Jersey several months ago. We were getting together every Sunday night to do like a family game night on Zoom, and all different types of games you can find online. We did like, you know, family Jeopardy things and trivia games and stuff. So we're not doing them quite as often, but still doing them. Did them again this past weekend. But like you, going to do a small Thanksgiving. Actually, supposed to have reasonably mild weather here in New Jersey, so we're going to be getting together in an open two-car garage. So we were over there today decorating with some patio lights and putting up cheap little dollar store shower curtains around the garage so you're not looking into the shovels and rakes hanging on the wall. So
that's cool.
Going to be our plan. But and I'm glad to hear about, I guess, the show on Thursday. I guess since it's Thanksgiving, I'm assuming we're still going to be running. So I guess it'll keep you from falling asleep with the tryptophan coma after the turkey. So we'll see how that works out. So anyway, tonight on Tech Tips, I thought I'd have a little bit of a chat about something called third order intermodulation distortion. Sounds like a big complicated topic, but it comes down to something that can happen in your receivers. And there's a very counterintuitive way of fixing it. So we're going to talk about that.
Well, that might be real interesting. I'm sure I probably have it and need to fix it. How about it, Glenn? Come in here, Glenn. What are you doing?
Oh, man, I'm still working on the book. I keep saying it's going to be a week or two and I'm done, and it sounds like I'm in a time loop. You get to this point in a book that it just starts growing extra arms and legs and you just can't chop them off fast enough.
You sound like the balloon going in circles.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, it's, you can see progress, but it's not the progress I want to see. Mm-hmm. But we're getting there. But I've got a little couple pictures to show tonight on where I'm at with it.
So. All right. We'll get into that in just a few minutes. God, I hope that our audience out there is hearing that our audio is much better tonight. I think we worked on it last week. I think we cleared up that 180 degree out of phase. Thank you, Ron, for telling us about that. And we downloaded a program where we could actually look at the phase. We fixed the phase and did a few other things. And I think it sounds much better now. All right. Let's see who we got left out there. We got Rich. Rich, what are you doing tonight?
I'm on this great show called Amateur Radio Roundtable.
Yeah.
check is in the mail.
That's right.
I'm just starting to get ready for Thanksgiving here too, and want to wish everybody out there a small, safe, and happy Thanksgiving, and encourage you to do your traveling by radio. And of course, we have the CQ Worldwide DXCW contest coming up this weekend. So since you probably won't be traveling, or you shouldn't be, you'll have more time to get on the radio. So get on, have fun, work lots and lots of people.
All right. Well, very good. Well, Katie, we're glad to have you back in here tonight. I know you were out last week, and I did take one of the stars off the off, you know, next to your name there last week, but you've got plenty of stars left, so you know you shouldn't be in any problem, you know, and you still have a lot of vacation days left carried over from last year. You'll be able to take those too. So don't worry about a thing.
My PTO.
Yeah, don't worry. Don't worry about a thing there. All right. Well, Katie, what are we going to talk about tonight?
Well, of course, it's the last Tuesday of the month, so which is why our friend Rich is here with us today. At the end of the month, we like to find out from the editor extraordinaire of CQ Magazine what's coming up in the next issue. So welcome back tonight. Welcome to Rich Moses in W2BU. Hi, Rich. How's it going? Again.
Oh, it's still going great. Great radio show.
I'm glad things haven't changed in the last minute.
So, I see watching on the monitor here, I see Glenn holding his one of his cats in his lap there. So we should
monster cat
welcome all the cats. Oh, there goes the cat.
The only way I can keep her quiet.
Yeah, I've got one floating around here someplace, but she's doesn't like to be on camera. What can I say?
So we're moving, getting closer to the end of the year of your 75th anniversary with CQ Magazine. So this is going to be the final episode for 2020 for you guys. What kind of things are you guys going to be sharing this episode?
In this episode,
maybe I'll just be quiet. I'm just gonna be quiet and let you talk.
Well, it's our technology special, and we've got a focus on contests, not on contesting, on antennas. But before I get to that, I wanted to talk about some contest things a little bit. We've got a really, really cool feature. Our contest editor, Tim Schoppe and 3QE, has distilled the calendar of major contests. And you remember the periodic table of elements on your high school chemistry classroom wall? Well, Tim has come up with a periodic table of amateur radio contests and has come up with a chart for the entire year of significant contest every weekend except two. There are only two weekends that don't have significant contests on them. That would be Christmas and the week before the CQ Worldwide single sideband contest, when everybody's getting ready for it. So I have it here in black and white. I don't have it in color, but you can see the way that it's going to look there.
Cool.
And it's color-coded for whether the contest is based on mode, whether it's CW, sideband, digital, multi-mode, VHF, UHF. He did a fantastic job on this, and the issue is going to be worthwhile just for this, if you're into contesting at all. Speaking of contests also, we've got some changes coming up in our WPX contest. We're adding a new category called multi-operator or multi-transmitter distributed, which is started out as another innovative way to do multi-op contesting without having all people in the same room. But this is intended really to be a permanent category that is going to be in all of the WPX contests, starting with the RIDI contest in January. I got to check on that. Oh, wait, I know. I'll look at the periodic table of contest calendars.
Hey, there you go.
The Ritty Sideband Ritty WPX contest is. Where's it here? No, it's there. There it is, February 13th and 14th. So.
Yeah, we have. I knew we had a certificate on the wall for that one, but it's been a while. We need to work on our skills, I think.
So we're starting with that one, and then the single sideband contest in March and the CWWPX in May. Adding this new multi-transmitter distributed category, it will let up to a group use up to six different transmitters in up to six different locations as basically a team. And they all operate under the same call sign. They have to be within the same DX entity and the same CQ zone. That's the only limitation on that. And other than that, it's a multi-op, multi-transmitter entry, but in its own category. And so that's going to be an exciting new approach to the contest for those who enjoy it. As I mentioned earlier, our tech special has a focus on antennas and antenna-related things this year. And we've got a whole bunch. We start out with kind of a basic article, but something that maybe not that familiar to a lot of people, which is how to tune a Yagi antenna. And by tuning the antenna, we're not talking about matching it. We're talking about the antenna itself and how to make it resonant where you want it to be without a matching network. And so that's a really interesting article on techniques for how to do that properly. Then we move into our mix and match with Arduinos and the things like that. We have a screwdriver antenna controller for your smartphone, which is it's Arduino based, and basically you can use your phone if you have a screwdriver antenna like on your car or something, rather than getting out to change a tap or to do the moving, you can use this device from your smartphone to change bands and change frequencies within a band. So that's very, very cool. We have a
Glenn, is that going to be in your book, Glenn?
No, probably not.
maybe the next one?
next one. Look, I've already lost half my hair on this one. I need some time. I want to play in some of these contests.
Oh, all right. There you go.
WPX is one of my favorites.
That's a great contest. That's okay. Yes. It's our Everybody Work Everybody contest, and that was what makes it so much fun.
Exactly.
Back on antennas, we have a self, this title is hard to read, a self-calibrating tuning tracking controller for magnetic field loop antennas. Figure that one out.
Wow.
But, you know, magnetic loop antennas are getting to be very popular for small spaces. And one of the problems that you have with it is that they have a very narrow bandwidth. And, you have to, if you're going to be changing frequency, you got to be running out to wherever the antenna is and tune a capacitor a little bit. So this is a self-calibrating tuning tracking controller. I don't think you can do it on your smartphone, but I believe there's an Arduino involved in there someplace. So that's also a part of our mix and match technology. We've got two articles on multiband vertical antennas. ACHEY has an article on how to build a portable, high-efficiency four-band vertical. This is intended to be taken out in the field with you and set up on a temporary basis. And we get you on, I believe, 2015 and 10. Well, there's a fourth band in there someplace. I think there's a 40-meter add-on for it. Then K5PA has another article on the Texas Star multiband antenna, which is five bands, not four, one feed line and no tuner. So we keep the verticals going there. And if you're into dipoles rather than verticals, W1IS and KC1DSQ, having trouble speaking tonight, have an article on a simple dual band upgrade for your 40 meter dipole. You know, a lot of us grew up with the belief that a 40 meter dipole is also resonant on 15 meters. And the answer to that is almost, because it's actually, if you have the antenna tuned properly, going back to our tuning, how to tune a Yagi, if you have an antenna tuned properly for the 40 meter band, then it's going to be resonant outside the 15 meter band, just above the top. If you have it tuned for 15, then it's going to be resonant outside the 40 meter band. So they have a rather simple project here where you're basically adding a capacitor into the middle of the antenna to bring it into resonance on both 40 and 15 meters in the parts of the band that you want them to be. And K1BQT has a ferrite sleeve auto transformer article. This one is back into matching as opposed to tuning. Auto transformers offer wide bandwidth, high efficiency, and excellent power handling capability to let you cover a wide range of frequencies on one antenna. Then Gordon West, WV6NOA, has a review for us of a battery box with brains, the Impulse Electronics Max Go Box. And this is not just a box you put a battery in to take with you. It's got all sorts of controllers and meters and stuff like that. A very, very interesting device. And if you're out in the field a lot, very, very useful to have along with you. Among our columns, Joe Eisenberg, K0NEB, gets us started on his shack rebuilding process. He's in the process of upgrading his shack, and he's sharing it in the magazine a step at a time. The December column is on grounding and being well grounded. In January, he's got another portion of it coming up. So by the time he's done, we will all know everything about his new station, inside out and backwards. We introduce our new emergency communications editor this month. Stan Broadway, N8BHL, is starting the column as of December. He is has written for us in the past. He's the Ohio Section Emergency Coordinator for the ARRL, and has done quite a bit of stuff on a statewide basis. First time he came to our attention was 4 years ago when he helped coordinate communications for, I think it was 5 major events in 4 cities in 1 week, including the Republican National Convention and a bunch of other large events. And he was kind of moving all the pieces around to make it all come together. And he wrote about that for us. And we're very pleased to have him join us as our emergency communications editor. And his topic this month is on exercises, which is a good winter activity. Do some get some planning and practice underway that may not make you go outside and do some virtual tabletops. Back to Arduinos and the like. Our microcontrollers column this month is on 2 projects and 2 books for Microcontroller Fund. And you'll have to read it, of course, to find out what the projects and what the books are. In Analog Adventures, Eric Nichols, KL7AJ, writes about getting more fun from your function generator. Should keep us funning for at least a month. And in the DX column, we take a look back at ham radio's role in a world event that some of us may remember. 1974 in Sikkim. The king of Sikkim was a ham, and there was a significant political difficulty there. India invaded his country, and he was kind of stuck in his palace, and The only communication out of Sikkim at that time was from the king via ham radio. And Bob N2OO writes about that this month for his column. And to wrap up our 75th anniversary celebrations, we do one more CQ classic, which I think we're going to continue the classic series in the future. We're not going to cut it off. I think it's people have enjoyed reading the old articles, and it may not be one every month, but we're going to continue. But we wrap up the year with an article from the first issue, the January 45 issue, called "Hams: Past, Present, and Future," by Zay Buch, WAQMR. And it's a really fascinating look at his view of the state of ham radio at the time. And you have to remember that at the time he wrote this and the time we published it, ham radio was still off the air for World War II. And so it's very, very fascinating look. So that is the highlights of our December issue. There is, of course, more on more stuff. And with that, I want to wish everyone a very happy and safe Thanksgiving. And the issue wishes you happy holidays more broadly, but we'll be back next month to do it in person. Katie?
Sounds good. And of course, as a reminder, if you don't already have your subscription to CQ Magazine, Rich, where can they go to get one?
www.cq-, where are those hyphens? amateur-radio.com. And then you can just click on subscribe here.
Great. And I assume you still have some calendars available?
Do have calendars. Yep. They are, I believe, $12.95 plus shipping. Great. And they're really cool this year. I think I talked about them a little bit last month. This is one of my favorites. And I love the calendar. Putting the calendars together is one of my favorite things to do every year. And because we really are able to pull all different aspects of the hobby into one kind of publication, even though it's a calendar. But you really get a sense of the people and activities across ham radio in the course of the 15 different pictures that we show you on the calendars each year.
And it makes a great gift if you say if your ham club is doing a holiday gathering of some sort and you're looking for some inexpensive door prizes to contribute. I mean, it's a great addition to it, or even a subscription, gift certificate for a subscription. So if you're working on some kind of a club gathering, even if it's going to be on Zoom, you could still do giveaways somehow. So keep that in mind for something if you are looking for some ideas. And if you're just not sure how to do it all, you can send off an email or call Dottie at the office. I'm sure she'll hook you up.
Yep. Absolutely.
Right. Great. Well, thank you so much, Rich. It was great to hear about all year long about the 75th anniversary from CQ Magazine and all of the interesting issues this year. And I know everybody always enjoys hearing about it. And we have lots of CQ Magazine fans out there that are listening to the show, and we appreciate your support of W5QB Amateur Radio Roundtable.
Yeah, and I can't wait to get that magazine. I want to build those antennas that's in there. Maybe we'll build one and talk about it on the show here. Maybe we can get the author on here and we'll do a show. Thanks, Rich.
One interesting thing that kind of slipped by during the course of the 75th anniversary was during the whole year here, this was our 76th year. So we are in January starting the 77th year of CQ. So it kind of just slipped by. Another thing that kind of slipped by me earlier this month, because it was my daughter and son-in-law's first wedding anniversary, was also my 50th anniversary of my first ham radio contact.
Wow.
November 9th, 1970. WA3JYO.
Happy anniversary. That's a neat one. Yeah. Wow.
Thank you.
I was almost one at that point.
Thank you so much, Rich. We'll see you next month.
Yep.
All right. Hey, let me make a quick announcement here. and maybe someone in the chat room can also explain it. There is a link problem going to our chat room, but if you'll just go to freenode.net, and click on the little chat. There's a little chat box there. Click on it. You can log into the chat room. It'll come up on the left side. You just put your nickname in, and you have to put the room name. The room name is #W5KUB, and that should get you into the chat room with the web-based client if you want to get in. So if I said that incorrectly, maybe somebody in the chat room can give some simple instructions there. Also, just real quick, let me announce again, since we are on famous international shortwave station, WBCQ, I just want to say hello to everyone out there. We're very interested in hearing from you out there on shortwave to see how our show is doing on our audio-only version, which is running on Thursdays from 5 to 7 p.m. on Thursdays on 7490 kilohertz. So shoot us an email to tom@w5kub.com, tom@w5kub.com, and let us know how it was, your listening experience here. We'll be right back, everybody. Don't go away. Let's talk about get out and be active with ICOM's new IC705. The IC705 is your perfect QRP companion as you have base station features and functionality at the tip of your fingers in a portable package. It covers HF through 70 centimeters. This compact rig weighs in at just over 2 pounds with RF direct sampling for most of the HF bands and IF sampling for frequencies above 25 megahertz. It also has a large 4.3-inch color touchscreen with live band scope and waterfall. You get 5 watts with the BP272 and 10 watts with a 13.8-volt DC power supply. It has a micro USB connector, Bluetooth, and WLAN. Integrated GPS with antenna and a GPS logger. It has a micro SD card slot. And the ATM243 speaker microphone comes standard. The perfect accessory for the IC705 is the LC192 backpack. It has a special compartment for your IC705 and room for all your accessories. The IC705 now has received FCC certification, and we expect product to be shipping to dealers by the end of September. Visit www.icomamerica.com/amateur for more information on ICOM radios.
LDG Electronics provides state-of-the-art antenna tuners for every amateur need. From QRP to QRO, fixed stations, portable and remote, an LDG tuner will match your radio to your antenna using our lightning-fast proprietary tuning algorithms. LDG is a family-owned and operated company dedicated to bringing innovative, quality products to the amateur market. All LDG products carry a full 2-year warranty that is fully transferable. Support is only a phone call or email away. We're always here to help you. Visit us on the web at ldgelectronics.com.
All right, guys, we're back, and this is Amateur Radio Roundtable, and we've had some fun so far. Let's go over to Alan. Alan always has something great to talk about, and I always learn something. So, Alan, why don't you go ahead and pick it up, and what are we going to talk about tonight?
All right. Well, tonight we're going to talk some more alphabet soup. This time, third-order intermodulation distortion, or third-order IMD. That's a big mouthful of words, but it boils down to a fairly simple phenomena. It's something that can happen in a receiver and or all kinds of RF circuits, but we're most concerned about what goes on in a receiver. And there's some interesting things you can do to deal with it. So that's what we're going to chat about here today. And let's see. Let me do a little. Oh, you got to let me share a screen there, Tom, before I can.
Okay. I'll fix that.
All right. And then, just kind of an interesting little topic. And all right, so let's go and share my PowerPoint presentation here and make that full screen. You guys should be able to see that now. All right. So this is just a very short little topic here, but kind of interesting. Third order IMD, or intermodulation distortion products in radio receivers. So again, this is the tech tips segment here. So we're going to get a little technical. So first thing we're going to talk about is, you know, what is, we'll just define kind of loosely, what is linearity and distortion. We'll define what IMD is, some of the properties of intermodulation distortion, and then the effects of IMD in a receiver, which you might have experienced, especially during busy band conditions like contest weekends and things like that, and then how to mitigate that. So let's get going. So first is let's talk about linearity and distortion. Linearity is kind of loosely defined as when the output of a circuit is really perfectly proportional to the input to the circuit, right? There's no distortion that's being added by that circuit. So that kind of tells you that it's that's kind of the definition of linearity. And of course, with most circuits or a lot of circuits, the degree of linearity of that circuit is going to depend upon input signal levels. And then obviously, if you overdrive a circuit or you have something that is nonlinear, you wind up creating some distortion. And distortion in circuits, that anything that alters the original shape of the waveform, leads to harmonic generation. So generating harmonic content from the original signal, as well as creating intermodulation distortion products or IMD products. We'll talk about those in a bit here. So that's kind of rough definition of linearity and distortion. So let's take a look at what we mean by linear and nonlinear circuits. Okay, passive circuits like, you know, passive filters and things like that are typically linear, right? Because they're, you can't overload a resistor unless you burn it out, type of thing. You know, it's not like you drive it, it's not like driving an amplifier into clipping or something like that. So many passive circuits are typically linear, except for things like if you've got elements that can get overdriven, like saturating the core of an inductor, for example. And amplifiers are ideally supposed to be linear, right? You don't want an amplifier to create any kind of a distortion in your signal, so they're ideally linear devices. But of course, things like saturation, cutoff, compression, large signal limiting, all of these things are forms of distortion that will create harmonic content as well as intermodulation distortion products. So mixers, which are very common in all of our radios and things like that, are really a common combination of both linear and nonlinear properties. We use the nonlinearity of mixers to our advantage. We want to have a mixer create mixing products, okay? Some of which are third order intermod products, and some are the products that we want. And we're usually with mixers, we are intentionally creating some indifferences of input signal frequencies and their harmonics. So we're really kind of taking advantage of the nonlinearity for some intended purposes, but sometimes you can also get some non-intended consequences. So that's what we're going to kind of talk about with the third order IMD. So let's talk first about harmonic distortion. What is that? So let's just consider a signal component at one frequency, like a single tone, okay? Call that F1. Harmonic distortion refers to essentially signal components that are going to be integer multiples of that fundamental signal. So at two times the that frequency, three times that frequency, four times that frequency, and so on, these things are called essentially the second, third, and fourth harmonic, of that fundamental signal. So you can call the fundamental the first harmonic, but we generally don't do that. We just call it the fundamental. But for any kind of a sinusoid that gets distorted, generally the distortion is going to appear as harmonic components, right? Essentially going to have the same ultimate period, but potentially at multiple cycles through the period of the fundamental. So a square wave, for example, is a good example. Square wave is essentially you've got energy at the fundamental and primarily at the odd harmonics, the third, the fifth, the seventh, et cetera. But that's kind of what harmonic distortion is. And this isn't directly, IMD, but we can certainly, we're going to be looking at IMD as it relates to some of the harmonics as well here. So just harmonics by themselves are generally not a problem in a receiver. Let's say we had a very strong signal at 14.2 megahertz in our receiver, really strong. but strong enough to cause harmonic distortion inside the receiver. Well, the harmonic distortion is going to be out at 28.4 megahertz, so the second harmonic, and the third harmonic is going to be beyond that, so well outside the passband of the receiver. So again, the harmonic distortion is generally not a problem inside a receiver because they're well out of band. Now, any nonlinearities in a circuit or overdriving a circuit will cause these harmonics to be generated and some IMDs to be generated. So let's talk about IMD products. So what are what is IMD? It stands for intermodulation distortion. Again, a big fancy mouthful of words, but it breaks down to really just being combinations, meaning sums and differences of the input frequencies, okay, and their harmonics. So the difference here, when we were talking about harmonics, we're just talking about a single input tone and the harmonic distortion products related to that tone. When we talk about intermodulation distortion products, we're talking about multiple input frequencies and then the harmonics of those multiple input frequencies. Okay. So let's, you know, looking at a picture, you know, something like this, where we've got, you know, two different signals coming into, say, a receiver, for example. Let's call them F1 and F2. Okay. If we take the sum and difference frequencies of those, and we often do this in a mixer to convert, you know, the RF input signal coming in down into an IF, you know, for further processing in a receiver. That's often done with using the difference frequency between, say, an input frequency and a local oscillator. But this could also be just two input frequencies coming in the antenna and hitting the mixer. So the sum of these two frequencies and the difference of these two frequencies are called the second order intermodulation distortion products. Okay. And again, generally not a problem. Okay, but they are created, and sometimes, like I said, sometimes they are intentional. Now, the second harmonics of the two input frequencies, 2 times F1, 2 times F2, as shown here, aren't really IMD products, but I drew them on here so that you can kind of see where they land with respect to the input signals. Again, pretty far away from the input signal, so we don't have to worry about them. Similarly, the third order harmonic distortion products, third order harmonics, again, pretty far away from the input signals. We don't have to worry about them. However, and then even then these other products, notice these other ones kind of in the middle of those third order harmonics, 2 times F1 plus F2 and 2 times F2 plus F1. These are intermod products because they are involving both input frequencies, F1 and F2. But one of them is the second harmonic of one, and the other one is the first harmonic, or the fundamental. They are also called third-order products. Okay, so and those third-order IMD products, again, pretty far away from our signals of interest, so we don't worry about them. Here's the guys that we worry about. Okay, these third-order intermod products that are composed of 2 times one of the frequencies minus the other one. These land pretty close to are signals of interest. Let's say the F1 and F2 are signals we're listening to or in band in the receiver. Those two signals are really strong and the receiver is driven into some kind of nonlinear operation. You can get these third order products that land in band, right? Very, very close to those two signals that are coming into the receiver. So these guys, big problem because they're often in band. Now, let's say we'll talk about an example here in terms of where that can be an issue. Now, there can be higher order products like fourth order, fifth order, you know, et cetera, by adding and subtracting combinations of, you know, higher order harmonics of those input signals. However, most of the time, the problems that you're going to run into in a receiver are going to be these third order products, these third order difference products. As shown in kind of the red shading here, because they're the ones that are going to be very close to those signals that are causing them. Okay. So let's take a look at some properties of third order IMD products. Okay. As we described in the previous graph, they're close to the fundamental frequencies, and this can cause these in-band problems in a receiver. And if you take a look at the generation of these signals, if you look at the green arrow is representing, you know, say along the x-axis, the input signal level, and then on the y-axis, the output signal level. So obviously, if we're as the input signal grows, the output signal grows, right? So you get this nice little, you know, straight line of input signal versus output signal through a device, a mixer, an amplifier, a filter, whatever it might be, okay? The third order products over that same input power range will increase at a rate 3 times faster than the third order products. So if the input signal doubles, the third order products generating from those input signals will grow 6 times, okay? So 3 times faster than the input signals. So there's a theoretical point that if you extend it out, those two signal levels would cross each other, meaning that the input signals, the pair of input signals that create the third order product will be at the same power level as the third order product, or really the other way around. The third order product grows to the point where it's equal to the input signal levels, okay? And that's called the third order intercept point. And it's a figure of merit that if you look on data sheets for receivers and things like that, you'll see sometimes the third order IMD or the third order intercept point will also be often be specified as really a measure of linearity of the receiver. The higher that number, the better, okay? Meaning that the lower distortion that that receiver has. But it's really a theoretical point, because if you truly try to increase the input signal levels of the pair of signals creating the third order product, you will reach a point where the amplifier will generally compress or limit before you ever get to that third order intercept product level. Okay, but the third order intercept point is still typically often, you know, given as a figure of merit, even though it's a point that you would typically never reach, you know, in a circuit. But you might see a spec for that. So if you're comparing receivers and looking for a receiver that's going to perform very well under very crowded, strong band conditions, the receiver that's got the highest third order intercept is going to be the one that's going to perform the best. So let's take a look at why do we care about all of this? Now that we've got all these things defined, we know what these mean, what really happens in a receiver, okay? Let's see, let's take a look here. So let's say I've got some IMD coming from strong in-band signals that are not on the signal that I'm trying to reach. Let's say I'm listening to a signal that's kind of weak, say right there at 14,200, right? Its signal level is kind of low. And again, it's a contest weekend. Band conditions are great. We're at the top of the cycle, and you might got a really strong signal at 14.203. Maybe got another really strong signal at 14.206, okay? So they might be, you know, 20, 30, 40 dB higher than the weak signal I'm trying to work, okay? If the receiver has some intermodulations, has some nonlinearity, it will generate a third order product at the sum and difference of, you know, 2 times F1 minus F2 and vice versa. So that third order product could actually cover up that weak signal at 14.200. So again, these crowded, strong signal conditions, you can get these intermod products that can cover up and basically raise your noise floor to the point where you can't hear these low level signals. So, but in reality, especially when we start talking about, you know, modulated signals like single sideband and things like that, it gets worse. Let's say there's that same signal at 14,200, maybe occupying 2.5-3 kHz of bandwidth in single sideband. I've got those same two strong signals at 14,203 and 206 occupying the same bandwidth. The reality is that intermod product is twice as wide as the signals that created it. Because if you look at the formula, it's 2 times one of the frequencies minus 1 times the other. So you're multiplying one of the signals by a factor of 2. So it actually increases its bandwidth by a factor of 2. So the third order products can be a real problem, because, you know, not only are they close to the signals you're trying to hear, but are wider than the original signals that created them. So they can be a real problematic. So again, when you've got these really strong band conditions, especially like on, you know, 75 or 40, and you turn all your preamps on and things like that to hear the weak signal, you can start getting all, you know, raising the noise floor without realizing that what you're doing is creating third order products inside your receiver. So what do we do about it? Okay, so we've got this situation here, you know, where I've got this third order product that's covering up my poor little signal at 14,200. And what's interesting is that attenuation can be your friend. Okay, so what do we mean by that? remember how we looked at the graph earlier, how those third order products grow three times faster than the input signals. Well, that also means that they drop faster than the input signals when you attenuate them. So let's say I add some attenuation. Okay, what goes on with these signal levels in the receiver? Well, let's say I added, say, 10 dB of attenuation, for example. Well, that weak signal I'm trying to hear, now he's 10 dB lower. Well, that didn't help me too much, right? So, but also those strong signals are also 10 dB lower. Well, it doesn't look like that situation's changed much. But the reality is that the third order intermod product that was created by those two input signals is now 30 dB lower than the original. So it's now dropped down below that weak signal that you want to hear. So even though that weak signal is weaker by adding attenuation, the distortion products are even weaker yet and may then uncover those weak signals you're actually trying to hear. So it's kind of counterintuitive that adding attenuation will help you hear weaker signals. Okay, and it's typically only true when the reason you can't hear that signal is because the noise floor is raised up due to these third order products from strong signals elsewhere in the band. So that weak signal essentially gets uncovered by taking advantage of the math that kind of is used to of the resulting of how the third order products are actually created. So the lessons learned. Nonlinearities can lead to distortion, such as, harmonic and intermodulation distortion products. The third order IMD are particularly troublesome because they are in band, meaning that they're closer to the signals of interest and certainly the signals that are in the passband of your receiver. And that counterintuitively, attenuation can sometimes help you hear the weak signals by dropping down those IMD products at a magnitude much larger than the amount of attenuation that you add. You get kind of a net benefit of dropping down that distortion more than the attenuator is taking away from the signal. So again, it's kind of a counterintuitive thing. But anyway, that was it. I did a video on this a year or two ago. The link is here, but if you just search on my YouTube channel, youtube.com/W2AEW, and just search for intermodulation distortion, you'll find that video. So anyway, that's all I had to share. I thought it was kind of an interesting short topic that sounds like a lot of complicated things going on, but the reality is that it's a pretty simple concept to understand with a counterintuitive solution.
Well, a lot of people will experience intermod. And there are ham radio adventures out there. And it seems like, boy, Timmy, all these real inexpensive VHF, UHF radios, seems like to me they're pretty good about picking it up.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, especially when you get into things like, repeaters and things like that, it can be a real problem because transmitters all over the place. You really have to start thinking about where these two times this frequency minus one times that frequency, and then all the other ones that are out there, then they all could kind of mix together. And like I said, sometimes a little bit of attenuation can go a long way to help solve these problems.
Yeah, it's amazing to think about all the signals that are around us right now. Just about every hertz in the spectrum, man, is hitting our body right now.
Yep. Sometimes it hurts.
Yeah. Oh, well, hey, thanks a lot for sharing that tonight. Sure. Looking forward to next week.
All right. I'll think of another topic for next week.
We'll see what you have next week here.
I don't know yet. We'll figure something out.
All right. Let's see. We're running, Glenn, you got a few minutes here, and then we're going to try to we'll get Bill in here. So let's shoot it over to Glenn, and I'm anxious to hear about your rotor box because I need to do something like that. Go ahead and take it, Glenn.
All right. I'm going to start sharing the screen here. It'll take a minute for all of this to get its act together here. We were saying in the break.
It's interesting. While Glenn's talking, the picture's not changing to him.
It's getting there. I've got about 13 windows open. This poor computer is just...
There we go.
Loaded to high heaven at the moment.
There we go.
So, yeah, let's see here. now. Let's see. Let's make it so I can see the screen. There we go. We were talking about the book earlier and how much it takes to get there. I think I've shown this before. This is the pile of notes I had when I started the book. And this is actually the results of the first book. You start with that really nice, neat, organized, you know, set of folders and everything. And by the time you get to the end of the book, each one of those piles is a chapter.
It looks like the, it looks like you hid the cat's catnip in that pile.
Yeah.
Oh, man. But, I don't know.
You know, the cats love it. You know, I mean, they just, but believe it or not, there's an organization to that mess, but that's usually how it ends up. And that's the reason why. Every time you try to take a picture, you get that. And anyway, what we're going to talk about tonight, this is one of the big chapters in the book, and I actually just finished that this chapter this morning. We were talking about it. It ended up being about 12,000 words, which came out to about 57 pages of double-spaced typing, which comes out to about 25 pages in the book, thereabouts. And what we're going to do is we're going to take the AR-40 rotator from High Gain, and we're going to modify it, and we're going to give it Arduino control. And these are the modifications. You got to cut a couple traces and add a few wires, add a little relay board that's going to control the rotation and sense the rotation and everything. And that's how we mounted it inside the AR-40 controller itself. Then we're going to build an Arduino board, and look at how complex this Arduino board is to do all of this work. You know, you've got the nano, handful of resistors, couple capacitors. That's pretty much it.
Yeah.
And then we add the TFT display to it. And we've got this cable that runs between it and the AR-40. And then we get a display like this, and it will actually control all of the rotation from Ham Radio Deluxe, so that you just sit back and, you know, click your screen and watch your rotators turn. This is the custom-built version of the AR-40. This one actually is built from scratch, and you can see we've given, the AR-40 is one where you have that dial, and you just kind of turn it to the direction and press start, and it goes. You can see we've added the digital display and the Arduino control to it, but we've also added a left-right rotate switch to it. So it's got all of the bells and whistles you could really want in this thing. And that's what the guts for it are looking like. And there's our connector going off to the antenna and everything. And you can see it's just not really all that complex for everything this thing is doing. And we got a little close-up here. There's our 16-bit A to D that's going to be accurate. You know, gosh, what is that? 32,300 to about 1/100th of a degree, if the electronics could actually do that, which it can't, but it's highly accurate on the position. The noise and everything on the signal would be worse than the actual resolution on this. Then there's a close-up of our display. You can see the dial pot that we have on top we track. So if you wanted to hit start, it would go to 5 degrees. And this
so
is
how,
what it would look like.
How are you controlling the Ham Radio Deluxe? You got a serial cable or a USB, or how you do that?
Yeah, Ham Radio Deluxe will control an antenna rotator if you just tell it what serial port it's attached to.
Oh, okay.
And I've got the Arduino here emulates the Yaesu GS232A rotor controller that takes serial commands and everything. So all I have to do is go into Ham Radio Deluxe and say, hey, you're talking to a Yaesu GS232 on COM6 in this case. Connect to it, and boom, you've got point-and-click capability through Ham Radio Deluxe, and, of course, your degrees are showing here. And that's actually two chapters. We're going to build one from scratch, and we're going to modify one. And like I say, I'm about a third of the way through the second one. And probably by this weekend, I'll have that finished. And then it's much simpler projects, much less complex projects from here on out. Let's see.
No, I haven't used Hammerhead Deluxe in a while. Is there anything on the map that's clickable? Can you click on the map or something and will it turn the rotor?
Just click anywhere on the screen and it will...
It'll point your antenna that way.
It'll point your antenna there. Yeah, all you got to do is literally point and click and it'll rotate it for you.
Cool.
And being able to do it with the Arduino is just that much cooler because think about it. What antenna rotator out there has automatic capability like this? You know, your high-end, high gains and some of the others, but you're talking a $600-$700 rotator.
Yeah.
And this mod on the AR-40 will cost you $30 maybe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I did the one for the CDE, you know, high gain, the old HAM-2, HAM-3, HAM-4s. And that only cost you like $20 to do.
Yeah, and you know, I have seen, you can buy a lot of rotors out there on these sale groups without a control box, and you can get them pretty cheap.
Right.
And you can just build your own control box up. You don't have to go out and find a control box, do you?
No. Matter of fact, a friend of mine actually bought a, or found a, was given a rotator. And I went out and built him one for him.
Yeah.
And again, that one cost maybe $30 or $40 to build, and it interfaced to Ham Radio Deluxe. And he's been using it ever since. Yeah, so it's not really that hard to do. The hardest part is figuring out how to connect everything. And Martin at over at MFJ gave me an AR-40 to tear apart and play with to my heart's content.
Well, that's cool.
And so I had it over here on the bench for probably about 3 months tearing it apart, figuring out how it worked. Because the interesting thing about that particular controller, it's turned off. There's no power going to it until you hit the start button. So you had to make a lot of changes to it so the power would stay on. But the way the rotator is designed, if the power's on, it's going to turn one direction or the other. There's no center off position.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to modify that whole little piece. And it ended up being, I think, like 7 trace cuts and 4 wires.
Well, that's a cool little project, and that's going to be in the book, right?
That is in the book, yes.
All right, so we'll have to buy the book.
Yeah, going to have to buy the book.
We'll get the book.
It's interesting, you know, hearing Rich talk about the CQ magazine this month. It sounds like there's just a boatload of Arduino articles going to be in it this month.
Yeah, it seems like it's getting even more popular now.
Yeah, it really is, which, you know, It's been going real good for a number of years, and it just keeps getting better and better. I mean, every week I'm going to try to show a different project that's going in the book. But believe it or not, these two are not, in my opinion, the best projects in the book. I have another couple that I'm really, really proud of. So,
you want to give us any hints?
Well, let's just say that we experiment a little with USB this time around. Oh gosh, what was one of the other ones? Oh, we plug into the CAT interfaces on the ASU radios. Of course, you can do this with the ICOMs and Kenwood as well.
Yeah.
Put those under Arduino control. So now your Arduino can automatically control the rig through the CAT port.
Oh, that'd be cool. That's something that probably a lot of people would like to do.
Yeah. So we actually have all of that finished and done. It's just the matter of writing it out. And I'm, like I say, I am down to the last 2 weeks, I would say, at this point. And when you get to this stage of a book, it's kind of like it grows arms and legs on you if you don't keep it under control. It's all too easy to go off on a tangent. And next thing you know, you're 3 chapters down that you didn't plan to write.
Well, I know that I know in talking to you and knowing you that you've been under a lot of stress the past year or so writing these books. And I think you're going to want to take a break here after this one.
Well, when I'm at this point, you hear me start whining. That means the book is almost done.
Yeah.
But I mean, actually, believe it or not, I actually have about four projects that are not going to be able to make the book due to size. Trying to keep the most relevant ones, and this is going to be time to research the others. But you're talking about stress in the book. Let's see. In the last year, I've had open heart surgery. It was, down and out for several months, and then the COVID lockdown and all of that. And it's just been a wacky, screwy year.
Yeah, it really has.
So, it really has. But actually, like I say, when I get to the point where I actually have the freedom to whine, that means I'm just about de-stressed. The book is almost done. So we're almost there.
All right. Well, Glenn, thanks so much, man, for that. And bring us something next week if you have it.
Oh, I have it. I've actually got all of the projects done and all of the pictures taken. It's just a matter of writing the text for the chapter, which goes very quickly for me. That's the easiest part of a book.
All right. Thank you again. Let's go over to Bill Brown. Bill, you still with us? You're out there, I think. Bill, where's Bill? Yep. I see. There's Bill. And I want to know what the heck's going on with W5KUB20, man. This is starting to get on my nerves, man.
It's taken a Southeast Asia tour, and it's been hanging around the Philippines and Indonesia and Malaysia. You've gone some interesting places. It's been down there for just about a week now, doing a big, slow circle. And I think you've gone some places that these Pico balloons have never gone, Malaysia, Indonesia, and the Philippines.
Hey, maybe we can make some kind of saying. We've gone places where nobody has ever gone.
Where no balloon has gone before.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
You see it did a big... almost did a perfect figure eight. If it continues on to the right, it just drew an eight. Latest prediction showing it actually looping towards Vietnam in a very slow, leisurely pace, taking about 4 days to get to Vietnam. Then it's going to go up towards, and you can see the variability. But the general trend is to head over in the general direction of Vietnam, and that's several days out on your prediction. That's like 4 days or more, so it may take even longer than that. That's my prediction I did recently.
So there's your prediction. You're showing us we're going to head back after going south again. We're going to head back to the west and go to Vietnam and
Hong Kong and Taiwan. And once it hits Taiwan, it's going to head up towards Japan and finally start hitting some good winds and heading towards Hawaii.
Well, man, I hope so, because
all kind of variable, as you can see from that other high split map that you showed. There's a lot of variability to this. So,
and I noticed there's still a couple chances of it going south right there. I mean, we came so close to the equator. Yeah,
several outliers to go back to Malaysia. So
yeah. Oh man!
But you almost hit the equator. You went down to 2 degrees north latitude. So you were right about where your cursor is. That's where the equator is.
Yeah,
and you were almost to it.
So the last report I saw, we were at 2 degrees. Now, there was about 17 hours. We don't know where it went. So. I don't know if it got. I don't know if it got any closer or if it already started turning back north. But boy, we got close, didn't we?
Yeah, you came very close to the equator. It's going slow. It's only going about 10 or 15 miles an hour the last few days. Sometimes not even that. But you will eventually start picking up speed after we get out of the doldrums there. So sometimes when you get out of the southern edge of the jet stream and you get into these calm areas, you can get stuck there for a while. So you're what they used to call in sailing, you're becalmed. So well, the same applies.
Eco-Boy. I'm getting real tired of getting stuck. You know, this is not fair. Everybody else keeps going, and we're stuck in a doing nothing. Yeah, we're stuck doing nothing here, man.
Just got to go for endurance instead of speed.
There you go.
Well, Bill, I kind of hinted to you. Let me see if I can get me on here. Hang on. Let's see.
But see, what Tom doesn't tell you is that the ants are being paid by the mile. So, you know, they make more money doing
this. Well, actually, this place here is totally remote control, and it's Arduino powered, and something's gone wrong.
Yeah, you wrote the sketch.
I can't write the first part of the sketch, but the ants are getting ready, though. Let me tell you, the ants are getting ready for the next flight, and I've kind of dropped this on Bill, and you know, there's really no balloon out there yet that really floats above 45,000. That's just about the max, man, and that's where everybody is stuck. Now I know people are trying, you know, and it'll eventually come, but we're gonna try ourselves to do something. And I was telling Bill the other day, we've got some ideas. I'm not really sure the ideas yet because he would probably laugh at us. But, you know, we're gonna try to get a balloon up in the 55,000-foot area. Now, I don't know how long it'll stay up. We've got to do some testing here next week to make sure our envelope will hold and doesn't leak, because there's going to be a lot of ceiling with it. I'll share more with that with you, Bill, offline. But, you know, the SBS balloon, I think the spreadsheet says it's 0.5 cubic meters. When I did the calculations, I came out about 0.6 cubic meters. So when I do the cubic meters on our proposed new device, it comes out 1.33 cubic meters. So we're twice the size in volume is the SBS. So if we can make it fly, Bill, shouldn't it take us higher?
Oh yeah, quite. It depends on the weight of the balloon, of course, but yeah, you would go higher.
Yeah.
The magic area is if you get up to 50,000 feet, 60,000 feet, then you're going to avoid 100% of the weather. So weather would no longer becomes an issue once you hit about 60,000 feet and also about 55,000 feet or so. So that would be a magic area to try and.
I'm excited about trying it. We're going to go for it. You know, hey, we're going to throw a tracker and track you on there. And hey, you know, it may come down in 8 hours. I have no idea, but we're going to go for it. And we're going to see if we can go 3 days or 30 days or 90 days.
Now, I'll tell you, there's an interesting variant. We've been doing the super pressure balloons with ham radio transmitters on them. They can go up, stay up for days and days and days. Of course, it needs helium or hydrogen to operate. But there's another type of balloon. They're called solar balloons.
I've been looking at those.
And there's been a fellow out in California that's been flying a number of them just recently. And the way you can tell they're solar balloons, they go up to about 65,000 feet and they'll stay there all day. And then right after sunset, they come down.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, he launched 3 or 4 in a row, and, he uses drop cloth that you can get at, these hardware stores, and, but he coats it with, tempura, a black powder to absorb the solar radiation and heat it up. And once it gets heated up, it'll take up a tracker and it'll stay up all day.
Bill, I found some a place you can order the solar balloon. And let me tell you, I saw a video, I'm launching one. A 50-foot, it's black, it's 50-foot long. It comes in a little box, smaller than a shoebox, and it got rolls it out, it's 50-foot long. It's 36 inches in diameter, 50 foot long. It's black. And he just runs around, fills it with air, ties the end off, and it comes with a string. It comes with 400 feet of string. And they were flying this solar balloon at the park, you know, up 300 feet in the air. It finally just took off. Now, here's a question. I know, like our balloons, we don't want black. We want kind of clear where the sun can go through it and all that kind of good stuff. We don't want it to heat up that much. But, and this is not what I'm going to do, but what if we took one of those 50-foot long solar balloons and we kept all the air out of it and we put just enough hydrogen in it to lift the weight of that 50-foot balloon, and when we launched it, just let it unroll, you know, it would be sealed, and you'd have 50 feet of balloon to expand in. I just wonder what the possibilities are. Now, it'd be black.
First of all, black, when they fly the black solar balloons, a friend of mine, Robert Rockte, KC8UCH, is a real pioneer in these solar balloons. He made something called a tetroon. He calls them sky diamonds. And it's a four-cornered way, but it's basically, you remember those little creamers that you can get at yeah. restaurants that that has a seam going one way and the other end of the package?
Yeah, yeah.
You make it the same way, and it simulates a sphere in a very simple way where you only do four linear heat welds, and or you can even tape it up for a solar balloon. But the problem he ran into when you were using the black, the solid black colored material, is that once it got up to altitude, it would actually melt and come down.
Oh, really? So, well, see, that my question was, if you put just enough hydrogen in here to lift it, and maybe an extra 10 grams to lift a payload, if you, and at 50 feet, if you had enough expansion, even the heat, of course, will expand that hydrogen, but you're thinking the balloon might melt up there?
It probably would. That's what he found, that they actually would melt. And we've been doing experiments with, you know, you've flown those silver Mylar balloons.
Yep.
Before, and we had one, of course, made it all the way to Japan, launched from Memphis, Tennessee.
Yeah.
Well, actually, that was launched.
Well, that was our first one. It went down in Japan.
And we launched that from Huntsville, Alabama here, and it went all the way to Japan on a single silver-colored party balloon. Turns out there's different colors you can buy. You can buy a red one and a gold one. And turns out we've tried that, both of them, the gold and the red, actually absorb so much heat that they overpressure and pop. So the silver seemed to work the best, and clear actually works better than the silver. But the silver was the least absorptive of the solar.
You know, if it wouldn't melt, I you'd have to calculate cubic feet and volume and lift and all that kind of stuff. But I mean, my thoughts are, you know, a 50-foot solar balloon with 50-foot solar balloon, that's probably got several hundred cubic feet of space. And if you could lift that with just a couple cubic feet of hydrogen, even though it gets hot, would that hydrogen expand past the capability of that 50-foot balloon?
Well, yeah, it would leak out. Depends on the material, but it would leak through the material. The SBS balloons that we've been flying successfully have a multi-layer of different plastic materials, and I think it's got polyvinyl alcohol in a layer in it too, and it. All designed to keep air out, and also has the side benefit of keeping hydrogen or helium inside. And if you just fly drop cloth material, what would happen is it would stay up all day and then come down at night. So because it wouldn't superpressure, the material would rip apart once you get up to altitude. If you closed it off, if you don't close it off, then you have what's known as a zero pressure balloon, and it goes up and it will float. But at night, you will lose 10% of your lift or a certain percentage of your lift, and you have to drop ballast. You can do that for up to 5 days, three to five days. So, and then it's a never ending, it's a losing battle because you keep having to drop ballast out.
So Bill, let me ask you a question. You know, when we launch these, they look empty. Are you saying basically once they're up there, that balloon is completely inflated? I mean, where it's almost stretching. Is that right?
Yeah, and it will stretch until
it breaks.
It either has met your pressure altitude, it can handle the overpressure for the free lift that you put in.
So here's my question. If you put less gas in it, it'll go a little higher. It'll go maybe higher, but then it'll still fill that balloon up. Is that right? As it goes higher, it's going to stretch more.
Well, it depends on the material. It'll stretch more, yeah. And if the material's not tough enough, it'll just tear the material apart.
You know, the Japanese, when they launched those fire bombs, those balloons from Japan during World War II into the United States, I was studying those, and they actually put nets over those balloons to keep them from expanding.
They were made out of mulberry paper and rubber.
Yeah.
And they were sewed by homemakers.
Yeah.
Their houses, and they were about 33 feet in diameter. Hydrogen.
But what I read, though, was that these nets that they'd put over it would keep it from, expanding far enough that it would break, it would burst the balloon.
Yeah, there is actually some methods that I've seen where you can put a net over to help keep a balloon from bursting. Yes, and similar to what they did. But they dropped off. They had big sandbags,
yeah.
And they had a pressure sensor, and it was just an analog barometer.
Yeah.
When it bellows. And when the bellows would make contact, when it started dropping down towards a certain altitude at night, it would drop off one of the sandbags, and up it would go again for another day. And they could get a week or more of flight time on those by dropping off a lot of ballast. And they had a 33-pound incendiary bomb on there. Their goal was to ignite the forests of the United States and cause a panic.
You know, and I read where maybe a couple of those were even discovered, you know, like years later. You know,
Michigan, as far east as Michigan, a farmer not too long ago found one while plowing his field in Michigan, and the bomb was still active.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So what if we focus on a net? Let's say we make us a net that weighs nothing and put it around our balloon. Is that going to help us?
Like I say, it can. They have some papers on that I can send you.
Oh, okay. All right. I'm looking for options here.
Yeah. What would be the restrictions on a 50-foot long balloon? Would that still qualify under the exemption that you're flying?
Well, yeah.
Probably would.
As long as it weighs, keeps under the weight limit, and the weight limit is 6 pounds per payload. And 12 pounds total, so we're probably going to be way under that. And what did you say your balloon that you were thinking of was about 100, over 100 grams or so, 150 grams?
Tell me the one that I'm thinking about working on.
Yeah,
I don't know exactly. I imagine it's going to be up probably 180, 190. Maybe 200 grams. I don't know.
Oh, that's not very. Yeah, that's not super heavy.
No, it's
all kinds of materials that you can use, and all kinds of designs, and it's just part of using ham radio to test, get the data down when you're testing these things. So.
Well, you know, the balloon is going to stretch. It's going to bust at some point if it goes too high. What we need to do is figure out how to take something like an air tank, you know, like one of these air tanks you fill your tire up with, and figure out how to put hydrogen in it and make it float.
And see, well,
that would hold the pressure, man. That would hold the pressure.
They if you can make a tank like that in the size of a big ball, and let's say you use carbon...
carbon fiber?
Nanotubes, yes. All right, or graphene, and you made a balloon shape, and you were able to suck a vacuum on it. I actually came up with a concept called the vacuum ball.
Oh, yeah.
And you would have the ideal balloon. But yeah. With today's technology, it would collapse.
Yeah. Well, we could inside, we could put some steel beams in here, you know, to hold the sides out, you know. You
wouldn't need hydrogen.
Yeah.
You'd make a vacuum.
Well, I guess just remove all the air, right? And it should go up. I guess if you can displace the weight of the air that...
That's correct.
Yeah, displace that much air. So that's another interesting thing. Okay. Now, you know, we're not going to also rule out our secret launch mixture. You know, we had a pretty successful flight where we mixed hydrogen and we mixed some party helium. And we have a secret mixture. We might put a little couple squirts of that in there, too, when we do this. I don't know. And again, we may run out of hydrogen, depending on this. If this is 1.3 cubic feet, we may run out of hydrogen before we get it to lift our payload. We may have to put a little bit of helium in it.
Okay.
All right. Well, I'm hoping. I'm hoping that Dash 20 gets out of here soon, but it ain't gonna be soon. I can tell by looking. It's I wouldn't doubt it doesn't go back over to Burma, you know, and circle around here a couple times, man.
Well, the predictions show it going to Vietnam and coming up the coast.
I don't know how we get so lucky on some of these flights, but.
You certainly go on some interesting journeys, let's put it that way.
Yeah. Well, all right. Hey, let me just, again, make an announcement, because we don't talk much to our shortwave listeners, but I'm kind of making an effort here to find out from our shortwave listeners that are listening to our show on WBCQ on 7490 on Thursdays between 5 and 7 p.m. Eastern Time. If you're listening to us, this is a ham radio show. We do a lot of fun and crazy things. We've been talking about a balloon launch that's going around the world right now. It's stuck in the Philippines. Hey, if you're listening out there, send us an email to tom@w5kub.com. tom@w5kub.com. Let us know where you are, and just also like to invite you, if you have internet, you can watch the show on Tuesday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern. I think that is 0200. Are we 6 hours now, Bill, 6 hours ahead, GMT? Okay, yeah. So let's see. That'd be 5 hours for Eastern, so... We come on at 9 p.m. Eastern, so that would be 0200 on Wednesday mornings if you'd like to join the show, if you have internet, and you can just go to w5kub.com and you can watch the show there. We do have a problem tonight on the chat room on our website. People are having to go directly to Freenode and log in. We'll fix that tonight. I can change one little letter on that page. You know, the page that has the video and the page that has the chat. I can change one little letter anywhere on that page. And WordPress likes to think it's smarter than me. And it will take out some code that makes the chat room work. So I've got to go in and manually put that back in. So we'll be doing that, and it'll work next week. Well, Bill, I know there's several other balloons flying right now. Anything exciting going on out there?
Well, we had three go around the world almost in formation. They went across the central U.S., one right after another, and they ended up out over the Atlantic within 20 or 30 miles of each other, and that was kind of exciting. And there's several that we have. One that was launched from a school in Pella, Iowa, WB0URW-8, and it's currently just off the coast of France, and it is on its second lap around the world, and so the students are very, very thrilled about that journey. In fact, the really neat thing about that one is that after it went around the world in just 12 days, which is pretty fast, it actually came within 70 miles of their school when it, and it went back to Iowa after going completely around the world, and just went 70 miles north of them. So they were really thrilled that not only did it go around the world, but it came back to Iowa and almost to their hometown again. So that was just the remarkable thing about the patterns of the jet stream. Sometimes you get the fast express ride around the world, and sometimes you get stuck in Southeast Asia.
Well, you said they've been going for what? They went around in 12 days. What altitude are they flying?
45,000
okay,
feet.
Okay. Yeah, well, we are too, but we've been up 17 days and we can't seem to get out of Asia. So
yeah.
We'll see how that goes.
But they were very lucky as they hit the they were going well over 100 miles an hour during a good portion of their flight. They were right in the thick of a great jet stream.
Well, and I guess they launched it a little bit further north, too, than we did. That might have helped.
That helped a lot. But as we get closer into the winter, that jet stream tends to dip down farther south so that we can get into that, too. But the northern tier states do have a little bit of an advantage, earlier in the season.
Well, I was okay with us being stuck here in the Philippines for a while. And I had to hope that we were going to cross the equator and that we were going to start flying in the southern hemisphere. I thought that would be cool if we can fly down here, but we didn't quite do it.
Now, Andy, VK3YT, launched one from Australia that actually crossed into the northern hemisphere as far north as Cuba, and went across the Gulf of Mexico and went back to the southern hemisphere again. So he made that transition and going north and then going south again. So it can be done. It's pretty rare. I had one go across the equator, like a sine wave, and it was going about 5 degrees plus or minus on my last lap on one of my flights. So once you get stuck down in the equator, it gets a little dicey because the weather, it's in the tropics and you get some pretty big storms there. So kind of a dangerous place for balloons.
I was looking at the storms and the high cloud tops all in the Philippines, man. It's all red down here right now where we've been flying. And I've been seeing cloud tops as high as of almost 52,000 feet.
I've seen them at 50,000
or more. Yeah, and so I really didn't know if it was going to come alive tonight or not, but we were pleasantly surprised tonight.
Doing fine.
Yeah.
Transmitting right now.
All right. Well, it's probably time to close the show, and I want to thank everybody for tuning in tonight. Sorry about the chat room problems if you didn't get in the chat room, but... we'll fix that link, and we'll try to put a link on there that if it happens again, you can click on and get on the chat room. But if you want to use an IRC client, there are plenty of free ones out there. Ice Chat is one. I personally use Hex Chat. There's MIRC, and all these are IRC programs that will allow you to do a lot more things on a chat room. Okay, we'll say goodnight to everybody. Bill, thank you for coming. Glenn, thank you. Alan, everybody, I think it's all still here with us. And we'll say goodnight to everybody, and we'll see you next week. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. My favorite holiday of the year is coming up in 2 days. I can remember it from a kid. Hey, I like Thanksgiving better than I like Christmas. I don't know what, maybe it's the food. I don't know what it is, man, but we used to really eat that dressing and, all that good stuff. I'm getting hungry right now, man, thinking about it.
I love it when it gets cold.
Oh, man. Well, Oh, well, I'm hungry. Not long ago, last week, I was putting a pump on a dishwasher, if you remember, right after the show. Tonight, it's not going to be here until tomorrow, but my heat sensor on my oven is, my oven temperature is not working correctly. It's going crazy. I did check the ohms on the sensor, and it's reading right at what it's supposed to read. Of course, the resistance changes as the heat gets in here. I've ordered a sensor just to see if that will fix it. Maybe it's a little defective. The test shows it is good. I mean, it's $19 for the heat sensor. If that doesn't fix it, the only other thing left is the control board. The control board, and it's got the clock and all that good stuff in here. And I've been looking on YouTube, and there's a lot of people that actually show how to repair those control boards. Most of the time, it's just a relay, like for the bake element or whatever. I think ours is sticking. I pulled the control board out and looked at it, but the relays, they didn't look charred or dark or anything, and they were sealed. I couldn't get them open. But I can get a whole new control board for less than $200. And, you know, if the sensor doesn't fix it tomorrow, I'll probably just put a control board in. I think that'll fix it. And it was that or spend about $4,000 and put another oven in. And I think we're going to want to go this route, I think.
This must be appliance week because I had to fix my dryer.
Yeah.
Last week, the heating coil went out and the guy fixed it or replaced it. And apparently there was still a problem. And it turned out that the heating coil that he put in had a short to the chassis. So it wasn't regulating temperature with the thermostat. Wow. It was always on.
Yeah. Yeah.
So got that all put back together. And my editor was talking about he was having an issue with the dryer. So this must be appliance week.
I'll tell you, appliances are just getting like cars now, man. There's a lot to them. It isn't just a heating element going to a switch, man. It's it's almost like it's got an Arduino in it, man. I mean, something's going on in there, man.
No, it doesn't have an Arduino in it, and that's the problem.
Is that the problem? Well, that's got some kind of smarts in it.
Actually, I think it's got something to do with the way things are being designed these days. You know, they design them for planned obsolescence, but they're making it so that they die a lot sooner. You know, they're almost got a planned lifetime in these things. You know, 3 days after the warranty dies, so you got to buy a new one because you can't get the parts to fix it.
Yeah. Hey, let me just ask the chat room real quick. Guys, does the audio sound much better tonight? I think it's much cleaner and crisper. And were the levels fairly decent tonight, guys? I didn't touch the levels one time. I was letting the compressor limiter do all the work. I just wondered how the audio sounded tonight. Well, we did some testing during this last week. Bill?
Yeah, it sounded pretty good.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's see, Bill. But you're not hearing, well, unless you're listening through the show, because what you're hearing, Bill, is not going through the compressor.
Oh, actually, I listened to it on the TV.
Did you? Okay.
We had YouTube put on the big TV.
Oh, okay. Cool.
And it sounded pretty good there.
Yeah, we listened to it also, and I think it sounds much better. We had a lot of good reports. We did a lot of testing this past week with a lot of people tuning in, and we got great reports on it. So I think we got to keep her here, and you know, we might could change our ratio of compression here where it's not quite as sharp, but I think we're okay. All right, again, good night, everybody. And it might be popping because I'm right in this mic. Maybe if I back up a little bit, it might not pop so much. Let me try the lapel mic.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you back up too much more, we won't be able to hear you.
Yeah, well, I'm on the lapel mic now. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I can get anywhere, see, with this lapel mic, and it's about the same. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
And you sound better on the lapel mic on Zoom.
I sound better on a lapel mic. Yeah, you're telling me this little $100 wireless mic sounds better than this $300
mic? Yeah, it's got more lows.
Mic.
Yeah.
Oh, it's man, full range. I noticed it. Okay. Well, anyway,
again for the fourth time. Good night, everybody. We enjoyed it. Have a happy Thanksgiving. See you guys later. 73 to everybody.
73. Good night.